Hi, you're listening to Go See a Show, the Off-Off-Broadway podcast. It's the holiday season, so it's time for holiday shows in the independent theater world. And on this episode of the podcast, a very special show about the power holidays can have. If you're not familiar with The Christmas Truce, you'll get a brief history lesson at the start of this episode. It's the story at the heart of In Fields Where They Lay, currently playing at the New Ohio. Dreamscape Theater tells that epic story on a human scale, as they like to say, and in doing so exposes some larger truths about the perceived boundaries and actual commonalities between human beings of all backgrounds. Some very important themes for the holiday season, and frankly, I think, for this moment in time in New York as well. I'll get out of the way and let director Brad Raimondo and actor Spencer Davis Milford discuss their lovely work. Take a listen.
I like to start with people's name on the mic, so we'll start with director...
Brad Raimondo.
And actor...
Spencer Davis Milford.
The show is In Fields Where They Lay. Who wrote the show?
The play's written by Ricardo Perez Gonzalez, who actually can't be here to talk to us tonight because he is in Michigan attending the Midwestern premiere of the show, which is happening this weekend.
And that's probably because this is a really great season for this show to be done. The show is about the Christmas truce, but like I'll let you guys kind of fill in the details about what exactly that is, in case folks have not heard. I don't know where you've been if you haven't heard of the Christmas Truce. It was 100 years ago. 100 years ago this winter.
This year, yes, in fact.
Phenomenal. Okay, so just what's the basic outline of what's going on here in the show?
Sure. So, and from talking to people over the past 6 years, which is how long I've been talking to people about this show and this story, my thoroughly unscientific polling indicates that about 50% of people have heard of this story, and 50% of people hear it for the first time
really?
When we tell it to them.
Maybe it's just because, like I said before we got on mic, I'm just one of those liberal peaceniks.
And I'll tell you what else. Absolutely. Those tend to be the people that know the story. But frankly, once you hear it, what I found is once you hear it, it sticks in your head. It's one of those things you don't hear and forget about. You hear it, and it holds space in your mind. So here's what happened. 1914, the first winter of World War I, roughly 6 months into the war, tens of thousands of men on all sides of the war, particularly in the case of this story, we're thinking about the German and the British troops who were serving on the Western Front. They'd been told when they signed up for this war, it's going to be over by Christmas. The Germans were telling their volunteers that. They were saying, the British, the French, the Belgians, they don't have the stomach for war. They will surrender, we'll negotiate terms, you'll be back in Berlin in time for the holidays. And the British volunteers who signed up got told essentially the same thing. They got told, we have the most disciplined, civilized, best trained, best equipped army that has ever been put in the field since ancient Rome. We're going to crush these barbarians. You'll be home by Christmas. So on December 24th, sitting in the trenches of the Western Front, very much not home by Christmas and having realized that they weren't getting home anytime soon, the men on both sides had settled in for a long, uncomfortable, terrible war, unlike the world had ever seen.
I thought you were going to make a really bad 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. You were on your way,
yeah,
Brad.
No, just, yeah, twas they thought 'twas the night before the worst Christmas ever, essentially. Three things happened on December 24th, 1914 that made a big difference. One was that for the first time in the entire war, the ground froze solid, which meant the mud, the 2 feet of mud they'd been wading in their trenches, all of a sudden turned into solid ground they could walk on.
So that was legit. That's not an invention for the script.
No, that's absolutely true from countless diaries and letters. Note that. And so that helped the guys feel a little more human. Men on both sides received Christmas gifts from home, both from their families and also thousands of German civilians shipped Christmas trees to the troops on the front lines, and thousands of English civilians paid into a fund organized by the princess to ship these brass Christmas gift boxes containing high-quality tobacco to the men on the front lines. So they're sitting in their trenches, they're walking on solid ground for the first time in months, they've got these gifts, and then the British soldiers see these Christmas trees with tiny little candles start going up along the German trenches. And shortly thereafter, they hear the sounds of the Germans starting to sing Christmas carols. And in many cases, they were singing German or Latin versions of carols that the British soldiers knew and that they knew their wives or parents or siblings or children were singing back home at that exact same moment. And so the Brits start singing back to the Germans. And in many places, messages start getting shouted across the lines. Most notoriously, and as we represented in our play, the phrase, "You no shoot, we no shoot," which on Christmas Day, 1914, in many places along the Western Front, is exactly what happened. For a day, the war essentially stopped. The armies essentially went on strike, got out of their trenches, met in no man's land, had conversations, exchanged gifts, and I think more importantly, went home at the end of that day having looked the guys on the other side in the face and having learned that whatever the propaganda said, they were human beings.
Yeah, because you represent that pretty well in the play, and it's one of those things that I think it's really hard for us in 2014 to remember that your character, Spencer, says something to the effect of, like, they really have fangs? I've heard that they have fangs. And
real ones have fangs.
Yeah, this is... From England to Germany. I mean, aren't there trains that can get there in under 12 hours?
Right.
Or like under 8? I don't even know. Like, right. It's really close.
Right. We looked at a lot of propaganda for this show, and a lot of the posters that they put up in Britain had these German who looked like vampires with the big pointy teeth and they have those big spiky hats which they wore in the war. And really scared a lot of the Germans, and the Germans played into that. They were like, well, if you think we're scary, then we'll play into it. You can think we're monsters, we're gonna beat you on the battlefield.
It's just so phenomenal to think this is only 100 years ago, that this sort of misinformation campaign, this sort of propaganda, and it makes, this is where I said, like, I want to get into the ideas of things. It's like, how is that happening now? And I think it probably is to a much lesser extent, but it is still there. It's
totally.
We now have the internet, so it's a little bit harder to have something like I think they like suck the blood of children, but you do have this, and you also had it represented really very well. And I kind of never thought of this, but there's so many of these poor kids who are illiterate.
Yeah,
they're out there fighting.
Not only kids, fully grown men.
Yeah.
Who are illiterate.
I mean, we really see that, like, struggle of communication, and that's a really big part of the show.
Absolutely.
So, and I loved that it was not only between, of course, you know, Tommy and Jerry, but Tom and Jerry, oh, wow, I never made that connection.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's where it comes
just
from.
Now. But you don't, it's not only there, but you see it amongst the soldiers, and you see it between the soldiers and home, you see it between the soldiers and the commanding officers. And now, you know the history on this, and this is maybe a little tangential, but I gotta ask you while it's here. I thought I had heard somewhere that in some places along the front, this lasted for a long time, like upwards of a week, and that there were problems actually between commanding officers and privates, like they basically had to be forced to fight. Is that true?
Yeah, there were so many variations, and one of the things, you know, so The mission statement of the Dreamscape Theater, our company, is to tell epic stories on a human scale.
Yeah, bring it back to theater, like, instead of me just getting into history here.
But
like,
well, no,
answer them both.
This goes exactly to why we told the story the way we did, and also how other ways we could have told it. So to us, it's about telling this epic story on a human scale, because it really is an epic story. There were so many variations in what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's worth noting, and we have a line about it in the play. There were places along the Western Front where nothing happened. There were places along the Western Front where this was a standard day of war. There was a German battleship in the English Channel shelling English villages, killing hundreds of civilians on Christmas Day 1914, while several hundred miles away, some men were shaking hands with their enemies. I mean, the war as a whole didn't stop, but in places, and in a lot of places, it did. And it ranged from just the singing on Christmas Eve and then a sort of reduction in fire to, you know, the story that we tell is, I think, sort of the iconic story of it, which is the men getting out of their trenches on Christmas Day.
Sharing cigarettes.
Sharing cigarettes. In some cases,
football, which is the iconic image of the men playing football.
Right,
yeah, I remember that one.
And the best evidence that we've been able to turn up in our research suggests that there were lots of little sort of disorganized football games. The popular idea that there was one massive football game.
Yeah. That's not realistic to the front.
That seems more like George Washington and the cherry tree. But certainly the idea of it, and certainly, you know, you have to believe that these, you know, these young men got out of their trenches on Christmas Day. They're out in a field for the first time in weeks. Someone's going to come up with some spherical object that they could start kicking
around.
Yeah, I read
somewhere that one of them used like a ham or something.
Sure,
Yeah.
Whatever you've got. But there were also cases, the other extreme, were cases where units essentially refused to go back to fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And several things happened. In some cases, units were broken up and men were reassigned to different battalions.
Oh, wow.
In some cases, more tragically, those units were placed, were rotated into areas that were under heavy shelling or under heavy attack, essentially to sort of teach the men to hate the enemy again. But yes, there were units that in which the truce did in fact persist through New Year's, and commanding officers did everything in their power in those cases to quash it. And that's one of the big questions in the show is not just what does it take for these men to stop shooting at each other, but then what does it take and what does it cost them to go back to shooting at each other, because as many historians have noted, the war did not in fact end in December of 1914.
No, it did not. This is pre-U.S. involvement even, right?
Yeah. By three years.
Yeah.
And it was very important to both Ricardo and myself to tell the whole story. That this is the story of the war pausing. This is the story of a group of men who said enough is enough, and for 24 hours, for 48 hours, for a week, enough was enough. But it's not. It is not a tragedy.
Yeah, it's. Yeah. I mean, you're certainly not Pollyanna-ish about this in any way. So I want to come back to. There's something you sort of touched on that I want to make sure I come back to. But I want to talk a little bit about maybe like the more just nuts and bolts of putting this together. You mentioned this is 6 years in the making.
Yeah.
Have you been in this for 6 years?
No, I...
You're too young to have been in this for 6 years.
Yeah, I was 13 when they started working on this.
Yeah, okay. But I was thinking, like, that guy is pretty close to 16.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm 19 now. They asked me to do the reading of this play back in January, and I read the script, and I had never heard of the Christmas Truce before.
You're young, man. So when my, like, smack talk earlier about you're young, it's okay.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I never heard of, they don't teach a lot about World War I in schools now. You always hear about World War II and the Nazis and how bad the Germans are. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't hear a lot about World War I. And when I read this play and heard about this story for the first time, I asked my dad, I was like, did that really happen? And he was like, yeah, like we have books about it. I went down and read a book in my house, a big encyclopedia my dad has on World War I, and I was like, yeah, I gotta do this reading. I gotta like tell this story. And so the reading went great. Fell in love with the cast. Brad was awesome. Ricardo was great. So the reading happened in January, and now it's December, and I'm here again. They were kind enough to ask me to reprise my role and play Jones.
Very, very nice work all
Thank
around,
you.
And you as well, especially. So. Why 6 years?
Sure.
Why? I mean, of course, this being the centennial, this is a really good time to do it. But what? Apart from all the lovely history you've imparted, and of course how it's obviously affected you, why stay with us for 6 years?
Sure. Well, that's a good question. This so this story has, as I said, this story sticks with people, and it certainly stuck with me. And this play has meant a ton for both Ricardo and myself. Here's the medium version of the long story. back in 2006, don't tell us, Spencer, how old you were then. In 2006, Ricardo and I were working together on a Dreamscape piece called The Burning Cities Project, which was a sort of collage play about based on eyewitness accounts to incidents of mass violence throughout the years. And it was inspired. It was an ensemble of people who had all been in Lower Manhattan on September 11th, 2001, came together to sort of reflect similar experiences throughout history. And this story came up in the room. It was talked about. And it just didn't fit the mission of that particular piece. Mm-hmm. But a couple of us, and myself in particular, just couldn't get it out of our heads. And so I went off and I did a ton of reading on it. And a few days after Christmas in 2008, Ricardo's been a longtime friend and collaborator of mine, and he and I were having breakfast on, must have been December 27th or 28th. And I said, now's the time. Now's the time to do the Christmas truce play. And he said, great, I want to write it. And Ricardo, I first met as an actor. He's a very fine actor and a very fine singer. And he had just started writing for performance in a really serious way. And this ended up being, the early draft of this play ended up being his first full-length play.
Wow.
And so we sat down at that diner and we worked out an outline for what we thought, you know, how do you create a play that's essentially about something not happening for a day? And most of what we came up with in that outline went out the window very quickly. But the what I will say without specifying it all, without spoiling anything, we wrote down the end of the play in that outline on that day. That was in some ways where the conversation started.
It's a poetic end, and you can see how, I can see how if you had that as an ending, how you can build toward that once you know that that's the right ending.
Yeah, it helped us know how and why we're telling this story.
Yes.
You know, and it does. If you're building a play, it helps to know what type of play you're building. And we decided that effectively we were building a hopeful tragedy. Mm-hmm. And so in early 2009, we cast an ensemble of actors, a very fine ensemble of actors, and we spent that year developing the play in collaboration with the actors. We would workshop it for a couple of weeks. Ricardo would go away and write. We would come in and workshop what he wrote. We would do some improvs. And people came in and out of the cast as they got cast in other gigs, as they went to grad school, as they left New York, as we discovered the need for new characters. The actor in this production who's been with it the longest is an actor named Zach Calhoun, who came in about halfway through that year. We decided we needed a really grizzled veteran to be the sergeant. We wanted someone who was tough and funny and who you could trust with your life, but you were also afraid, like, might kick your ass. And Ricardo and I were like, who does it? Oh, Zach Calhoun. And so we brought Zach in, and that was, in fact, Zach coming in was in some ways the turning point when Ricardo really took it and ran with it and delivered this fantastic draft. So at the end of 2009, we produced it at the Hudson Guild Theater for a 3-week run. We got wonderful audience responses. We got some good press. And we were both so proud of our work on it and so happy with the work that Ricardo and I both immediately then went to grad school and had no time to think about it for 3 years.
And cue centennial.
Exactly. And then 3 years later, Ricardo and I were both coming out of grad school with a lot of further work under our belts. And we were looking at, oh, we're coming up on the centennial of the truce. We're coming up on 2014. Let's dust that script off and see if it's as good as we remember it. Ricardo went back and reread it and immediately sent me an update in which he cut 17 pages worth of material. And then over the past year, starting with the January reading when we brought Spencer on board, along with another fantastic cast, Ricardo and I have been going back and forth and workshopping it. There are rewrites on this stage that happened at Tech. There's a major rewrite. Spencer's got maybe one of my favorite moments in the play in a discovery that he makes in conversation with a German that was the result of a piece of research that an actor sent us the week after our first table read. He sent us an interview. He managed, an actor in the cast, Joe Colbo, who plays Lieutenant Jeffries, managed to find an interview about the Christmas truce that neither Ricardo or I had ever seen, which took some doing on his part. And this guy who was actually serving on the same part of the front where our story takes place just shared this one anecdote that we've written into
about the
play.
About cigarette cases?
Yes, about
that's really cool.
Why the Germans and the British believed they were fighting and how similar those things were. And it's become one of my favorite things, and that is a pretty late addition. So it's had some pauses over those 6 years, but it's been fermenting in my mind and in the playwright's mind for all that time.
Well, it's certainly a very powerful story. I think we've covered a lot of ground here. This is great. Thank you guys so much for like a really beautiful story. I think this is the sort of like story you want at Christmas time. At least like again, liberal peacenik me loves this story and loves well, and I love the way you treated the story. Like it's not just a look, let's all kumbaya. It's like I think it's about the power of stories in a larger way.
Especially after what's happened over this past year, the past few months, really, it's this story about how we're all human and we're all the same deep down. It's people need to realize that now more than ever. So it's a perfect story for the time we're at in America, especially.
Yeah, no, it's been particularly this month. It's I think all of us have at one point or another had a moment where we've really felt like this is the right time to be working on telling a story about a group of armed men in uniforms deciding to put their guns down for a little while and think about who the people are on the other side. And that's been, that's a responsibility, but it's been a powerful thing, I think, for all of us at various moments. And we've had audiences talk to us about that, which is really gratifying. For all of us to be able, I mean, it's what we dream of as theater artists, that we could tell this 100-year-old story and both honor the history, but also hopefully in some way add to a conversation that's going on right now.
Well, you did it. Thank you guys for a great show and for doing this for chatting.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you, Brad and Spencer, for hanging out after the show to chat, and thanks for the beer. I like this recent theme of sharing a beer during Go See a Show interviews. You can catch In Fields Where They Lay at The New Ohio, 154 Christopher Street in Manhattan, through December 27th, 2014, Wednesdays and Thursdays at 7 p.m., Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m., and Sundays at 5 p.m., with no show on Christmas Day, of course. Head to dreamscapetheater.org, and that's theater with an R-E, for tickets and more information. Thanks to you for listening into the podcast. If you dig it, please give it a like on Facebook, facebook.com/GoSeeAShow. Follow @GoSeeAShow on Twitter and rate or comment on the show's iTunes page. Until next time, go see a show and happy holidays.
Wonderful. Thank you, man.
Thank you, guys. This was really cool.